This is the Radio Check Podcast, life in the concert touring industry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Radio Check Podcast. I'm Matt Kanzi, and of course, I'm here with my brother, Chris Kanzi. Hey, man, how's it going?
I'm good, brother Matt. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
We saw each other recently over Easter. We had a little family get together, so it was nice to hang and
and
just be amongst the family. So that was pretty cool.
That was cool. We don't get together like that very often, and it was interesting and fun and well overdue, I suppose. But yeah, and it was great to see you and everybody. And yeah, it was an interesting weekend for sure. Yeah, but I mean, other than that, it's, we were talking ahead of time about finding opportunities to get together face to face again throughout the year, and hopefully we'll be able to manifest something like that.
Yeah. Got to do more.
Yeah. So, just out of curiosity, since, I mean, you know, we're sitting here able to podcast, and usually when we're doing this these days, it's because you're home. How much longer are you home until you kick back off onto the road?
Well, I've got a one-off this month, the month of April. I've got a one-off and that I've got to go do. But I don't leave to actually do touring in earnest till late May.
Oh.
Some rehearsals that launch into three legs of Europe.
Right on. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, all that being said, we did, there's not a lot much to catch up on because we did see each other last weekend. So I'm just going to hand it off to you here. And you know, this is great because yet another individual I've heard the name slung around quite a bit for a long, long time, in small talk and in the circles you hang in. But I've never met him before, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his story and you guys kind of bantering back and forth because you've got a pretty long history. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what's going on today?
Yeah, it sure is a name. It is a name. I think I just asked him here off here is. Is it Gooch or the Gooch?
And of course, my response is, it's neither, really. It is whatever you want it to be.
Hey, man, it's really good to see you. Thanks for doing this with us.
Yeah, it's great to see you too. Matt, good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And you just got home, right? You're just fresh home from a European tour, right?
Day before yesterday, yeah. So I got home.
Okay. Thank you.
Hours ago.
So you were just you were just out with Depeche Mode. Is that the end of that campaign?
That is the end of the Memento Mori tour. Who knows what comes next?
Yeah. They're always wondering whether it's the last.
Right. Every single tour, everybody's like, is it the end? I don't have the answer to that. I certainly hope not. And I think that they've got a lot more in their tank. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, well, me, I'm a huge fan. I came to the show in Twickenham last year. I would love for them to do more and record, but this was the first tour without Fletch.
It was.
And how was that? Was that, what was it like touring without Fletch?
Different, a lot different, very sad that he's passed and, he was missed every day. The beautiful thing about it, I think it brought Dave and Martin a lot closer together. Both on stage and off stage. So the performances definitely showed their connection a lot tighter. And I think, Memento Mori means everything must die, which they had picked before Fletch passed. So bittersweet maybe is the word.
Yeah.
Their shows were definitely a lot more intense. His presence was felt, but their relationship growing stronger and back to, when they were younger, brought them to a whole different level. So it was, the shows were spectacular.
Yeah.
Some of them really emotional, some of them, normal shows, but all of them great in their own right.
Yeah. Not only am I referencing the show that I saw, but I, as the Depeche Mode nerd that I am, I watched a bunch of the YouTube footage and I kind of wish I saw the indoor show. I prefer indoors to outdoors for any show. I just think it sounds better. It looks better. You can contain things a lot better.
It's definitely more intimate. And they were, I can't say anything bad about any of the shows. They were all great. But definitely indoors, there's a different intensity. They're closer to the audience, even though you're doing, you know, arenas that fit 20, 25,000 people. It's still a different vibe. And obviously Eastern Europe, Germany, Hungary, all that.
Yeah.
They're really intense fans.
Yeah. A sea of black lipstick.
Like swarm. It's funny. Well, you go into these cities and you see people in their everyday bustle. But when you get closer to where the hotel is or the city center, you just start seeing everybody in black and you think, is there a goth convention going on? What's going on here?
Well, you know, getting them in and out of the hotel in those situations is can be tricky, right? Or do you do like the service elevator through the kitchen into the back door kind of thing? Or what do you do?
A lot. Yeah. In Eastern Europe, definitely. You know, it's if we're in a place where there's only a couple hundred people outside, they'll come out the front door. But, you know, when you've got a couple thousand people standing out front, they go through the garage entrances or service entrances. And, you know, and you try to explain to people, look, they're not coming out here. You're standing here all day and they're not going to come through this door. And they all say, yeah, sure. Okay. You're lying to us. You know, and you're stand here all day. Enjoy yourself. Yeah.
I've done loadouts where we're loading the last truck into a 4-hour loadout. There's people still standing in there thinking that the artist is going to come out. I'm like, man, I'm telling you, they've been gone for 4 hours.
It's insane. You know, last three shows were in Cologne. We were in Turin before. It was Turin, Budapest, Cologne. No, Turin, Budapest, Milan, Cologne. And we were in Milan for a week before we got to Cologne. And while we were in Turin, people were lined up outside the arena in Cologne. So well over a week, week and a half before the show started.
Wow.
Saving that sacred position of early entry.
Yeah, GA floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, take me back. How long have you worked for Depeche Mode? How many campaigns is this for you?
This was the fourth tour, but 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going back, I mean, they were sober by then. I mean, other than Fletch, pardon me, but you know, but
yes.
Martin and Dave, you know, famous for their, you know, partying back in the devotional tour days. I've talked to Franksy about that, and it's just, you know, how fucking nuts those guys were, you know, dying and being brought back to life and all that.
It's the ultimate rock and roll story.
Yeah, it totally
is.
Yeah,
no, I was fortunate. I came in after they were sober. So the shenanigans have stopped. They're very professional. They're very routine oriented. It's a machine and it's very well run. You know, Kessler, obviously you work with him a bit. So you've experienced him and he's very, and he's very detail oriented and he makes things run smoothly all the time.
I can imagine. I mean, Jonathan Kessler, the manager of Depeche Mode, and Alex Pollock, one of the management team of Depeche Mode. I work with both of them with Coldplay, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I have an incredible amount of respect and regard for both of those guys. I mean, Alex Pollock, if he's in the room, he's the smartest guy in the room.
He's literally the smartest guy on earth.
Very much enjoy our dynamic with them. But going back to what we were just talking about the post-partying, I mean, this is something that you've learned over your career, the navigation of this. I mean, going back to, you know, you were the tour manager for the Smashing Pumpkins in their heyday. And we all know that, you know, Jimmy struggled with drugs and obviously Jonathan Melvoin passed away on the road from heroin overdose. And, you know, then you went on to work for Stone Temple Pilots with Scott Weiland. You know, I mean, you've been around this and it can't be easy. It's delicate and what have you got to say about that? What have you learned?
I've learned the trouble follows me.
Yes, it does.
Either that or I'm a glutton, you know? Yeah, it's, you know, I guess the thing that I've taken out of all of it is don't take anything too seriously. You know, we're in the entertainment business. Nothing's the end of the world. maybe not even death, you know, I don't know. But I'm pretty calm now. You know, I just, anybody I work with, I come in and I figure out what's needed to get the job done the best I can. And, you know, you learn from that. You know, I work with Neil Young as well. And I was talking with somebody yesterday because we're going out soon. And she was asking me, she worked, you know, he went out and did like a 5-day run on the West Coast, a solo acoustic thing without me and without Steve Dromowski. So there was nobody from the tour production management side of things on that. And it was a bit chaotic. I'm sure the shows were great, but everybody says that things were all over the road and they were trying to figure out how it all worked and all that. And Neil's a different creature. You know, he works differently than anybody. It's all about energy and vibe, and he does what he wants to do. And if you can facilitate his vision, you're good. You know what I mean? So, and everybody asked me, well, how'd you figure it out? And I said, I just came in and asked him what he wanted. And he told me what he wanted. And I said, okay, give me a week or so to figure out how to do that. And I'll put it together and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we didn't talk much after that. I just put it together and it all worked out. And he was like, this is great. This is exactly what I want.
Nice. Yeah, well, he's always been a guy that goes by the beat of his own drum. Yeah, I mean, he's like you said, he's unique. He does things his way. He doesn't care how anybody else does it. He doesn't compare himself or his methods to anybody. It's just, this is me. This is what I want. This is how it is.
But I think that's every artist, you know? And a lot of times you come into a camp, you know, when you get hired, somebody brings you in, they go, okay, Chris, tell me, what would you do? And you got to think for a second, go, well, what exactly do you want? I mean, I can't tell you what I would do until I know what you want and what we're doing, but we can start here and work our way through it. But until you get to that point, you know, it's, everything's not a template. You know, like I had a guy come in the other day, and a guy who's working on the tour with us, and he came in, he said, hey, can I bother you for a minute? And I said, sure. And he sat down and he looked at me, he goes, so if somebody needed to learn how to tour manage in like 2 to 3 weeks, what would you tell them? You know, and I started laughing and I said, well, I've been doing it for 35 years and I'm still learning. So there's not a lot I can tell you, you know? And he's like, well, I got an offer to tour manage somebody and I've never done it and I don't know what I'm doing. And I said, if you want to do it, go tell that artist that you've never been a tour manager, but you're willing to jump on and do what they need and do it. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I can't teach you, you know, it's based on relationships and everything that I've learned through my career. You know, you can't just walk in and go, okay, I got this. Or, you know, today I want to be the production manager.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a,
well, I mean, I'm sure you've worked with many of artists where that you've not had the opportunity to have that meeting like you did with Neil Young, where you just had to go in and figure it out as you go along and learn the idiosyncrasies and all the little criteria they expect in real time.
Absolutely. I mean, with Neil, it was instant. I mean, I came in, Eric Johnson was his tour manager forever, and he was off doing a film project, actually a TV show project, the TV show Roadies. And he needed somebody to fill in. And Elliot Roberts, who's Neil's manager, he called me and said, hey, Steve Dromowski told me you're not working. Are you available? And I said, to come work with Neil? Definitely. You know, and he's like, great. How much are you going to pay me? So yeah. I said, I'm not going to pay you over $100,000, Elliot, but I'm in. Yeah. The next day I flew out and they're already on the road. And like I said, I just sat down with Neil and said, what do you want? And he told me what he wanted and we made it happen.
Fortunately, nice. Elliot Roberts, he's a legend. He's passed in the last few years, hasn't he?
He passed the day we were flying to Europe for the last tour.
Oh, okay.
Which was
a legend. Yeah. Legend. He goes back to the 70s with Joni Mitchell and Jackson Brown and Crosby, Stills and Nash. And he was one of that, you know, the Laurel Canyon guys.
He started the first big management company and he had everybody on his roster. And brilliant, amazing stories. I wish he was still around to tell you, you know, all the things he's told me. They're pretty amazing.
I can imagine.
He's one.
So, go ahead.
He is one of a kind. He's, you know, I learned a lot from him. I first worked with him, you know, the Pumpkins did a couple of the Bridge School benefits. So I met him on those and thought he was great. And then when the Pumpkins broke up and Billy put Zwan back together, we needed somebody. So we called Elliot and he came in and we worked together on that project and it was amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you just went back there. Let's go back as Matt and I like to do. I don't even know. Are you a Chicago guy? I mean, I know you lived in Chicago. Were you raised in Chicago? Is that where you came from?
I was raised in upstate New York.
Okay.
So my introduction to the music world was I was working construction and got hurt on the job and wasn't able to work, you know, so I'm hanging out with friends and friends that are in bands. And one of them, the guy said, "Hey man, can you come on the road with me?" He was a solo acoustic musician who sometimes had a band. And I said, "Sure." And went out and helped him set up his stuff and collected money at the door and all that stuff. And he had a sound guy that was really terrible. And I said, "This guy's awful. You need to get somebody to do sound." And he's like, "Well, can you do it?" I have no idea. So I went into boot camp. There was a guy who owned a sound company in Syracuse. And we went to him and said, "Hey, can you teach me how to do sound?" And he said, "If you'll work in the shop for free, I'll teach you how to do sound." So all day, all night, I was working in a shop, building cabinets and wiring things and learning about signal paths and all that kind of stuff. And that turned into him teaching me how to mix. And for, you know, 2-3 years, I was mixing sound and on the road. And
really? Just out of high school?
Yeah. Still in college. I was still taking college classes. And, you know, I was going to school for culinary arts. I wanted to be a chef.
Wow.
Yeah. But then I realized the people that I was working with in school were chefs and I was a cook, you know, and you get that like, shit, this is probably not the career for me. These guys are amazing. I'm going to end up working in shitty restaurants the rest of my life. I should move on.
So let's move to Chicago where there's lots of restaurants.
Right. Well, that was another one. It was a weird, we jumped in the van with the band. It was a 3-piece band. We had all the gear in the van. So we booked a little tour out through Chicago into Colorado and back, and then stopped in Chicago and did some recording because a guy we knew from Syracuse owned a recording studio in Chicago.
Nice. Stopped
there for a week. It was summertime. It was beautiful. And I fell in love with the city. Then we went to Colorado, came back. We're in Chicago for another week. And halfway through the week, I was just like, fuck it. I'm moving here.
Wow.
And I said it to the singer, which it was his group. And I said, "Hey, we should move to Chicago." But he was a really big fish in a small pond on the East Coast. So he wanted to stick with the program that he knew because he was, you know, this is 90 or 91. And he's probably making $300,000-$400,000 a year as a solo artist, cash.
Oh, wow.
So he was doing really well. But he had the ability to go big. So we went, you know, I moved to Chicago. He came out for about a month. And he said, "This isn't for me. I'm going back to Syracuse." So he moved back there and he's still there doing shows in the same places he was 35 years ago.
Really? Still?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Super talented guy, but just wasn't fortunate enough to make that leap.
Well, you know, he made a living doing what he loves. And,
yeah,
exactly. You know, a lot of people can't do that.
Exactly. I mean, he opened for Dylan. He opened for 10,000 Maniacs. He was doing tons of stuff on the East Coast. I think he was afraid to go big.
Right.
And that's where he stayed.
Right. So, okay. You decided to stay in Chicago. I mean, how did you plant your flag?
That's kind of a funny story because one of my roommates in Syracuse, because he went to Syracuse University, he had a roommate that was in college at Syracuse and he had graduated. His roommate graduated and moved back to Chicago. That's where he was from. So he said, "If you want to go to Chicago, you should give Scotty a call." So I called him up and I said, "Hey, I'm going to move to Chicago. Do you any ideas where I should live, what I should do?" And he said, "My roommate's moving out in 2 weeks. If you want to wait 2 weeks." So I packed all my stuff. I said, "Great." His roommate moved out. The next day I moved in. And then I reached out to another friend in Colorado who managed Big Head Todd and the Monsters, who used to live in Chicago.
Okay.
"Hey, you're from Chicago. I'm moving there. I need a gig. you know, where should I go? And he said, you should go to the Metro and look for Joe Shanahan and Joe Prino.
Oh, man.
Said to Scotty, hey, do you know where Metro is? And he walks me to the front window of our, my new apartment. And he says, you see the flag on the building over there? That's the Metro. So I lived a half a block away from Metro.
Really?
So I was like, great, I'll be back in a little while. I walked out, walked across the street through the alley. I go up to the front of Metro. I'm looking, pulling on the doors. They're not opening. I'm looking around. I'm like, how do you get into this place? And two guys come over. And they're like, hey, can we help you? And I said, yeah, do you know how to get into this place? And they said, well, it's closed. What are you looking for? And I said, I'm looking for Joe Shanahan and Joe Prino. A friend of mine told me to come talk to them about a job. And one of the guys goes, what's your friend's name? And I said, Matt Need. And he put his hand out and he shook my hand and he said, I'm Joe Prino. And I said, oh, great. You know, can we talk about a job? He goes, no, come back tonight at 9. You're hired. And I was like, seriously? And he said, yeah, we'll see you tonight. Without talking about what I do or what I need, any of that. So I went back to my apartment. I told Scott, I said, I just got hired at Metro. You know, and he does the, there's no way. And I said, seriously, I'm going back tonight at 9. So I go back at 9, I walk in, you know, everybody, the security and everybody at the front door, they're like, can we help you? And I said, yeah, I'm here for a job. Joe Prino told me to come back tonight at 9 o'clock and look for David. So they introduced me to this guy, David. He takes me in the office, gives me an application. I did the, ah, shit, I just got the brush off, you know, like fill out this application. We'll call you, kid.
Oh, right.
And he's like, hello. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he's right here. Oh, okay. Cool. Thanks, Joe. And he hangs up the phone and he grabs the application, throws it away. He's like, you're hired. And I said, doing what? And he goes, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a sound engineer, but I'll do anything. You know, you need me to take out the garbage? I'll take out the garbage. And he said, well, we have a show tonight, so I need you to do security. And because I'm little, I fit the bill. It was a Dead Milkmen show and he put me on stage catching people like flying like crazy.
And is there a barricade?
No. And there were four of us stuffed between the stage and people crushing us and just grabbing people and pushing them back because they just kept flying over. And,
right.
You know, and then the show ends, everybody leaves and the manager of the place, he's like, hey, you got a job here. That was great. You know,
wow,
without even talking to you, you just went in there and dealt with it. That was fantastic. And
how old were you?
22, maybe 21.
Okay. Yeah. And, but you know, for the listeners who may not have ever met Gooch, he said he was small. He's not small. You know how when they call a big guy tiny, you know, that's the situation that he's referring to. How funny.
Yeah, it was great.
So,
and then, you know, I worked with local bands. You meet a lot of local bands. So I was working with some really bad metal bands that I won't mention. Anytime I left to go on the road, Joe would let me come back right away. Whether it was doing, you know, working as a stagehand or working production, mixing, working as a barback, doing security, whatever. I always had a job. So whatever right. needed to be filled, he let me come back in, slide right back in. And he always looked out for me. And, I think I was out with Material Issue, which is a Chicago pop band. And we came home and Joe called me and said, hey, can you come over? I need to talk to you. So I said, sure. I came over and he said, I need you to go down to Paul Elge's photography studio and meet this band. They're starting to blow up and they need somebody to help. And I said, well, who is it? And he said, the Smashing Pumpkins. And I was like, nah, I'm not interested. You know, Jimmy had spent a lot of time in Smart Bar.
Smart Bar, what's that?
Smart Bar is the club.
That's the club downstairs.
Which is the 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. on the weekends club.
Right.
It was dark right. and not much light and lots of dark things happening. And Jimmy was doing a lot of dark things. And I was like, no, not my cup of tea. You know, and he said, just go meet him. See if you get along with him. Just do me a favor, take the meeting. If you don't like it, you don't have to take, you know, you don't have to do it. If they don't like you, you won't have a job. So I went down, met with him, sat for a few hours and then a few more hours. And it just turned into this, you know, it was a great meeting. And, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? Nothing. What do you need? Well, come by rehearsal and we'll talk. And went by rehearsal, talked even more. And they said, we need to talk about it. And James had somebody that he wanted to come in and take over. Because they hadn't really had a tour manager. They just had their fans.
Where are they in the point of their career? Where are they? Did Gish come out yet? Are they still working on their?
Gish was out. They had just finished Siamese Dream. So it was,
okay.
They're getting ready to kick off. They're doing rehearsals and getting ready to hit the road with Siamese Dream.
Wow, that's huge, because they eventually went on to headline Lollapalooza on that campaign. I mean, that thing, it must have exploded huge and quick.
It went from theaters to arenas in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
And then in comes Bill Ramey. So that's my first introduction to Bill, was walking into arena in Normal, Illinois. And, you know, and I had long hair, you know, 6'5", 260 pounds with long hair. And I walk in, there's this 6'5", 280 pound Lebanese dude with long hair and a long beard. And I'm like, holy shit. And he's like, brother, we're the Scimitars. And I'm like, excuse me. You know, and he's like, you're my tag team wrestling partner. That's it. You know, and he sent out for masks and the whole thing, and
around
telling everybody that we were tag team wrestling partners, with me going, we're not. We're definitely not tag team wrestling partners. He's going, we are. We are. We're professional.
Oh, funny. Because he loves the wrestling. That's his thing, man.
Him and Corbin, they're both way into it. And to me, it's, you know, I don't get it. It doesn't do anything for me. I understand the entertainment aspect of it and the money aspect of it, but it's just, I can't buy into it. You know?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Folks, and they were way into it. And he was legitimately trying to make people believe that we were wrestling partners.
It's not hard to dismiss, you know. It is.
There's a photo somewhere. I used to have it. I don't know where I put it, but I know he's got a copy of it too, or may not have it anymore. But we were doing the MTV Music Video Awards live broadcast in Munich, right? Massive show, simulcast to the world. And the Pumpkins were headlining it, but Chumbawamba was on earlier in the day. And the singer from Chumbawamba got underneath the stage and wrote punk on his chest and got naked. And he waited under there until the Pumpkins went on. Then he climbed up the front of stage and he's up there jumping around butt naked on worldwide live broadcast. So there's Ramey on one side of the stage, me on the other side of the stage, and we both kind of walk out there, and the guy's running around butt naked, and I'm like, I'm not touching this guy. And Ramey's got a big flashlight in his hand. He's like, I'm not touching that guy either. I was like, grab him, Bill. He's like, no way, brother. And he ran around and jumped around, then he jumped off the stage and went underneath. You know, I think in the long run, they pulled the Chumbawamba performance from the broadcast because it was going to be broadcast later.
Uh-huh.
And then a few weeks later, we go back to Metro for another kind of end of tour show. And in the dressing room, there's a Polaroid of the singer from Chumbawamba naked with his foot up on a chair saying, greetings from Chumbawamba.
Oh, the Metro, man. I mean, I've only been there once, but it's one of those places you only have to be there once to remember it forever, because everything had to go up the stairs. You know, I've carried a console up that stairs. I mean,
I've carried many consoles up that stairs back when the sound booth used to be in the balcony. So you'd have to take the one that was in there out and bring it down to put it in storage, and then carry one all the way up to the balcony. And they eventually moved the sound booth to the main floor, but it was interesting.
That's a venue in Chicago. That's a venue in Chicago, right? Yeah. I also carried a console and equipment up those stairs.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's up at Wrigley Field.
Yeah. I recall the stairs terribly.
Oh, and everybody, I mean, the Stones have played there. I mean, it's just one of those classic places where it doesn't matter that it's small and grungy and shitty with stairs. It's people just want to play there.
Everybody. I've seen U2 in there. I've seen Prince there. Sting. You know, Dead Milkmen, Front 242, you name it. It's just every band you can imagine has come and gone, you know. And the last time Stones were in and played in a small club, Joe Shanahan, who owns the Metro, he owned a place called Double Door, which is a 350 to 400 seat place, just a bar, tiny little stage. They came in and they played at Double Door, which was fucking mayhem, like crazy.
No, I can imagine.
They had to stuff 600 or 700, maybe 800 people in there, and all the people outside, you know, it's on the corner. So it's got two streets, and the streets are full of people because the Stones were coming into this tiny club, and it's pretty spectacular. A lot of good times.
Okay, so Pumpkins, this turned into a year-round gig for you, right? Moving for quite a few years, didn't it?
Yeah, after Lollapalooza, they were taking a break. And Billy said, can you stay on and take care of everything that's going on? We need to find a rehearsal space and build a rehearsal space and start writing the next record. So, well, they all split for vacation. I went back to Chicago and looked for a warehouse, a suitable building to build a rehearsal space in. And yeah. I found this really great building that turned into what they coined Pumpkinland. And there's a big garage in the back, warehouse storage space, this giant live room. You know, we made a little ISO booth for recording. If you needed to record, put an amp in there, put a vocal mic in there and just track rehearsals. And then a big lounge in the front, you know, with a kitchen, bathroom, dining room area, hangout, TV, video games, all that kind of stuff. And they started writing the Melancholy record.
Wow.
And it's when they first started working with Flood, he flew over and came into rehearsals, and he spent like a week. And after that week, he's looking around the building, and he said, you know, that this place sounds incredible. And he said, can we record in here? You know, and me being the genius I am said, yeah, of course we can record in here. What do you need to record? And he said, well, we need a control room and isolation and blah, blah, blah. And he left, and Billy's like, you think we can record in here? And I was like, sure, just give me a little time. So they gave me a month to build it out. So me and a friend of mine started construction work and built soundproof walls and air gaps and separated things and isolation, and came up with the idea of building ISO cabinets and the mobile ISO cabinets and putting them out in the garage and switching everything. So we kept the, you know, they rehearse in the round. So we kept everything the way it was so they can continuously rehearse. And when they wanted to record, their AB boxes. So the two guitar amps and bass amp would switch to the ISO cabinets out in the garage, and they'd put their cans on and start recording. And, you know, the drums would be the only live thing in the room. And then we'd track it and kept sending DAT tapes back to Flood, and he would listen to things, and they worked on things more and more and more. And got closer to the end of it. They started taking it out to Double Door. So for a month, we went to Double Door every Friday and Saturday night and performed the new stuff in front of
Towns
and gauged the reaction of the crowd, and went back and they worked on more stuff and changed things and did this and that. And then Flood came back and we'd finished the construction, finished wiring up the studio, and tracked everything there.
So Melancholy was recorded in this warehouse?
Yeah, in their rehearsal.
I didn't know that, because that was a prolific time for Billy and the band. I mean, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness is, what, 2 hours of music? I mean, it's an incredible amount of material there.
They work really hard. They're, you know, it's 12 hours a day, 6.5 days a week in the studio. You know, noon to midnight every day. And he would come in an hour early and, you know, work on his tones and things. And the rest of the band would show up and they'd go right to work, and they'd work till midnight.
Yeah.
Always working on things. So the double album could have been a quadruple album. There's enough material there. You know, they've released box sets along the way that have different
versions
and unreleased songs. And at the end of it, I remember Billy made a thing called Smash Potatoes for Darcy, James, and Jimmy for Christmas. And it was 5 CD sets of unreleased material from Melancholy.
Wow.
Each of them were different. So that's 15 CDs worth of different unreleased material that he gave to those guys from that recording session. So,
wow.
And there's probably another 40 or 50 songs in there that never got released, just because it's, you know, it's idea after idea after idea. And there were whiteboards of things that, you know, you're keeping and what you were tracking and what was done, what wasn't done, you know, and then, you know, cross-referencing and going, should we keep this one? Is this an album track or no? you know, and imagine a wall of whiteboards with check marks and, you know, going through this chart and trying to figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work, and then actually picking the songs and then finishing them. And then we went into Chicago Recording Company, CRC, to do the final bits, you know, some of the vocal things and overdubs and orchestra parts, and, you know, brought an orchestra in and tracked for Tonight and a couple other things. And it was cool.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I spent a part of one of my years with them in 2019. I worked with them, and my takeaway is that they are the most well-rehearsed band I've ever worked for. Yeah. You know, they would just work hard and rehearse and rehearse and then sound check. I mean, nothing was left well enough. You know, I mean, there was always room for improvement, and man, did they rehearse.
I don't know if they still do it, but when I was with them, they recorded every sound check, recorded every show. We had ADAT machines on the road with Bruce Knight mixing front of house and swapping tapes, you know, figuring out what song, where they needed to break and talk to the audience so that he could swap tapes and put new tapes in, and all of that archived and put into storage.
Yeah.
As well as everything being videotaped. You know, we had videographers on the road with us filming everything backstage, record company dinners, hotels, flights, you know, fights. Everything you can imagine is over-documented.
Yeah.
And he had all of that in storage. I don't know if he'll ever do anything with it, or it's, you know, a generation to come or the generation after that where somebody goes, okay, let's take this on. And, you know, his kids or his grandkids decide they want to sell it for something and make something, but every single thing was documented.
Well, he's still recording. I mean, they're still prolific. I mean, there's almost an album a year now.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be a Billy solo record or it be the Pumpkins or whether, you know, you go back to Zwan. I mean, it just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming.
Yeah, after Zwan, when everything departed there and there was uncertainty if it was going to continue or not, he went in, instead of going home and, you know, having a little vacation, he went home and made an acoustic record with songs about Chicago. So the loosely based on the White City and the, based on the White City and the 1896 World's Fair.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. I love that book, The Devil in the White City. What a brilliant piece of work that is. Love it.
Amazing. I don't know if you've ever walked the park down there, Jackson Park. There's still a museum there. The Museum of Science and Industry is the only building left from the World's Fair because they built it so fast. They built it out of
it's cheap.
Really cheap and material that, you know, washed away in the rain. You know, because it was a very Venetian grand Asia meets Italy kind of vibe. And some really cool buildings, but they all broke apart. But we've gone down there and walked through it. And, you know, the Center of Progress building was the largest building in history, you know.
Wow.
So, and when you go to the space where it was, you're like, holy fuck, you know.
Yeah. There's an architect, a Chicago architect named Daniel Burnham.
Yeah.
Who actually, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Frank Lloyd Wright learn from him? I think Frank Lloyd Wright worked underneath Daniel Burnham.
Yes.
You know, and the guy who did Central Park in New York came in and did the grounds.
Right, which,
you know,
is,
I mean, that must have been amazing.
Olmsted, I think Olmsted did Central Park. He came in. There's another landscape architect that came in and worked with him on that, who ended up doing a lot of the estates on the North Shore of Chicago. So like the Morton Estate, which was Morton Salt, and then Armour Meats. I don't know if you remember that name, but Armour was the family that made, they were the largest meat producer in the U.S. because the Chicago Stockyards were there, you know, in the early 1900s. And that was the largest slaughterhouse facility in the world. So everything came through there, and Armour Meats was the largest producer of meats, and they would ship from Chicago to everywhere in the world. So of course the Armour Estate, which is in Lake Forest. And I think that's the place that Mr. T bought. And the story that I've heard from the Historical Society, because Billy's house is in Highland Park, so he's close, you know, and he was doing a restoration of this place that he bought, which was an Adler estate, which is an incredible house. So you meet all these people and the, you know, the architects and the, everybody's coming to you to preserve the property and, you know, hey, we should make this, put this into a landmark trust so that nobody can change it and all that kind of stuff. And so they're all trying to take you to dinner and get you to sign off on this so they have access to the place and all that. So you meet all these people and you hear all the stories, but one of the guys that was working on the restoration of his place did the restoration of the Armour estate. And he showed me the photos of it back in its grandeur, you know, and it was incredible. And the story of it was that Mr. T wanted to put a big T on the gate and the city of Highland Park protested it and they wanted it to come down and they took it to city council and they voted on it. So they went and told them, you need to remove the T from the gate. You know, it's, it doesn't fit into the neighborhood and your neighbors are not into it. So he packed his shit and he left, and he left a bunch of his guys still living in the house. And he told them to get some chainsaws and cut down every tree on the property. So they went and they took down every tree on this property, which was done by, I can't remember the architect's name, but he was Olmsted's apprentice.
Mature trees.
Massive, massive mature trees. Yeah. It was pretty,
oh man.
It was a pretty horrible thing. When you see the original pictures and you look what was done, you're like, oh my God.
Oh man. I mean, that city is just so, such a wealth of history, you know, to that city. And you know, whether the music industry or sports or architecture, or I just love that place, man. I can see myself living in Chicago. It's 1,000%.
It's a pretty spectacular city. It's my favorite place in the U.S. I live in Tennessee now because I like the country, and we have a small farm that, you know, as you can see all the plants behind me, these are, my wife and kids are growing their seedlings to put in the ground for the garden.
Nice.
They start everything from seeds. And then at the end of the year, they take all the seeds back and dry them all out and, you know, put them in envelopes and categorize them to grow next year. And they move all over the place. So
where about in Tennessee or what city?
South of Nashville. I'm in Franklin.
Okay. Okay. I know Franklin. Yeah. I know Franklin. I've been there.
I'm not in proper downtown Franklin. I'm in unincorporated. I'm out in the country. So.
Nice.
Moved here, my neighbors were cattle. Now they're billionaires.
Which wow.
Kind of interesting.
Did you move there for the industry? Do you find yourself exchanging anything with the Nashville scene?
I did move here. Doc McGee convinced me to move here. Like, I was working with Kiss and he's like, you need to come down. He had his office, you know, brought me in, showed me his office. I need somebody to come take care of, you know, to handle all the touring stuff. You got to move here. You got to move here. You got to move here. I was like, Doc, I'm not leaving Chicago. I'm certainly not going to Nashville, you know? But he convinced me. So I came down. It took me about a year to find a place that I liked. And we found this place and I was like, this is it. It's, you know,
wow.
You can't see my neighbor's houses. You know, we have a good piece of land. It's got a creek that runs through it. It's peaceful, you know? So I was like, okay, I'll move. And then literally about a week after moving in, he had a massive heart attack and went, you know, quadruple bypass surgery and all that stuff. And he decided he was going to cut everybody loose except for Kiss. And he was going to focus on getting healthy in his life. And that was that.
Right.
I moved to Tennessee for a gig and there was no gig when I got here, but it's, you know, it's worked out.
But you're happy.
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a, I almost said love hate relationship, but that's not true. I mean, there's a lot of things about Nashville that I really like, you know. I mean, I don't, you know, downtown with all the, you know, the, was it Broadway with all the clubs and, you know, I could do without that, but
I never,
you know, East Nashville, you know, I mean, you know, where Q Prime's office is. It's so beautiful. And, you know, some of the restaurants, Germantown, I do really like a lot of Nashville.
I didn't know Q Prime was here.
Yeah, they have Q Prime Nashville. You know, it's not a Mention Bernstein office, but it's a, you know, they do have
Mention's in the UK now, I think, right?
Oh, I don't know.
I think he's predominantly living in the UK. I could be wrong. I haven't talked to him in quite a few years too. So
yeah, it's been a while. Hey, cause so Pumpkins, you know, I'd have to say, and Matt would probably agree, I remember back in those days during the, the Siamese Dream melancholy year. I mean, they might have been my favorite band. I mean, I might have been the Smashing Pumpkins are my favorite band. They were just so freaking good, man.
They were amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like really
And
amazing.
I think I met you. I think the first time I met you, because Bill was a friend. Bill and I, before he worked for the Pumpkins, I knew Bill. We toured together. I went to a Melancholy show at the Forum in LA. And I think that's where it was a quick hello where he introduced me to you briefly.
Yeah. I remember that. And I
And then
remember
Friends
seeing
Forever.
you at some festival too. I want to say in the UK, maybe like Download or Leeds or Reading or Glasgow,
Yeah.
one of those
Yeah.
festivals you were at.
Yeah. Well, I had
You were doing
Zwan on
Sound.
a couple festivals.
Were you doing Soundgarden?
I did Soundgarden in the early 90s, the Bad Motorfinger era. That's where
Amazing.
I did Soundgarden. I
But
was 91.
you weren't with them at that point. But
No.
that's the first time I saw Soundgarden in a place called The Haunt in Ithaca, New York.
Oh, wow.
Fucking mind, like blew my mind. I don't know if you remember The Haunt, but it was a tiny little club. I'm sure you were in some pretty insane clubs, but it was at Cornell. And it was one of the most intense shows I've ever seen. Like,
I
really,
can imagine.
I was like, holy shit, this is the future of rock music. This is where it's going. Well,
Yeah. Matt, do you remember that when we went to go see, Matt and I went to go see, it was, I think Voivod
who's
was the
Voivod?
headliner,
Yeah. Soundgarden
and then
opened for Voivod.
Soundgarden on Loud Love, and then Faith No More on The Real Thing, where the opening act was three band bill. We saw it in Boston. We liked it so much we drove to New York the next day and saw it again.
Yeah, we saw it twice in a row. That was
That
fantastic.
was so mighty, so freaking mighty. Did
Really
we even
intense.
stay for Voivod? I don't know if we did.
We didn't stay for, well, I think we saw the first song in one of the nights, but yeah,
Yeah.
we were just like, hey, we need to, because both gigs we went to, we drove 2 hours to get to. So
Right.
we, you
It's
know,
unfair
it's
for
time
them.
to get
I mean,
up.
how do you follow Soundgarden?
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
there's some things you can't do. And
Yeah.
that was at the point where grunge was really starting to come to life, and you
It
know,
was.
all these other bands, Mudhoney, and you know, I remember seeing Chili Peppers in the Lost Horizon in Syracuse to like 150 people and going, wow, this is insane. 2 years later, they came back with Pearl Jam and the Pumpkins. And that was the first time I saw the Pumpkins. They were in the middle
Yeah.
slot and Pearl Jam came out, and I was like, show's over. Nobody's going to beat this. That was insane. You know, of course, it
Yep.
was on acid and it was really amazing. But,
Well, that was the East Coast. On the East Coast, it was just on the Blood Sugar Sex Magik tour. It was Chili Peppers, Pumpkins, and I think Pearl Jam was the opening act.
yes.
On the West Coast, I did that tour. I did the West Coast part because it was in arenas. So it was with instead of the Pumpkins, it was Nirvana on Nevermind. So it was Pearl Jam on their very first tour, Nirvana and Nevermind, followed by the Chili Peppers on Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and I did a whole run of arenas with them as the stage manager. And I ran into Dave Grohl recently, and we were talking about those days, and it was really, really super fun, just reminiscing about just how fucking nuts
It was
that
really
run was.
nuts. Yeah, I remember 10 came out. Well, Nevermind came out first and then 10 after that, right?
I don't know the order, but it was within the same year
Yeah, all Butch Vig
or
records.
yeah.
And Gish was a Butch Vig record. You know, you're like, and so was Siamese Dream. So it was pretty amazing. It was the change from glam rock to angry alternative rock, grunge rock, you know,
Yeah.
these misfit kids that didn't fit anywhere and were
Yeah.
pissed off at the world and were ready to take over.
Yep. Everybody wore their long underwear underneath their shorts with a flannel shirt.
Yeah, and then you had the Pumpkins with Billy wearing high waters with mismatched socks and, you know, nylon shirts going, what's going on here? You know,
What an
deal with
intense
the
guy Billy
mullet.
is, an intense guy. I management, was happy with me, and says, I don't know how you did it, but you made Billy happy. But I couldn't tell. The best thing I could do with Billy is just to stand in front of him, look him in the eye, and tell him what's up. Don't tap dance. Don't make excuses. Just say, this is what happened. we're going to fix it, or here's the schedule for the day, whatever, you know, whether it was good news or mediocre news, you just look him right in the eye, and he would just say, okay, you know,
he knows what he's doing. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's a very prolific songwriter and very intense performer. Socially, I don't think he really has time for, you know, chit chat. He's pretty deep into his thoughts and what he wants to create and how he wants it to work. So he's, you know, the brain's always working on that. So hanging.
I always thought that he would rather stick a red hot burning fork in his own eye than say, please, thank you, or good job.
That's without a doubt.
There are none of those. Okay, so your career's moving along. It's Pumpkins straight through Siamese Dream, straight through Melancholy, which goes straight into A Door, which was kind of after A Door is where it started getting little sticky, right? Or was it before A Door?
Melancholy, you know, it was.
Oh, Jimmy
and Jonathan
were
you know, fucking up a little bit, and they were doing stupid shit. And the first overdose happened in Bangkok, you know.
First.
Yeah. The first.
For Jonathan or Jimmy?
Both. Both, you know. Everybody's in the van and Billy's going, where the fuck are they? I'm like, hang on. And I go back into the hotel and I'm knocking on the doors like, where the fuck are you? They're not answering, neither of them. So I get the manager to come up and open the door and it's got the deadbolt thing on, you know. So I break the door in and they're both laying on the floor, you know, foam coming out of their mouth. You're like, shit. You know, doing this, like looking at the manager, like, get the fuck out. And then dragging him into the shower and punching him and giving him kidney punches and sternum rubs. And, you know, they wake up and they're like, what the fuck, you know? And you're like, get your shit. We're late. We're flying to Singapore. Hurry up, you know? And they're scrambling to grab their bags and stumble down to the van and jump in and go to the airport and, you know, throwing up in garbage cans as you're going through the airport and we're trying to make our flight and you get on the plane and you're like, hey, just so you know, drug trafficking is punishable by death in Singapore. I hope you don't have anything on you, you know, and then they like turn gray. You're like, I hope that they don't realize that you've got drugs in your system and they test your blood because they'll just shoot you, you know, and they're both like, so we get into Singapore. Immediately, you know, run off to some venue where we're doing a radio show and do the show. And it's really great and go back to the hotel. And obviously James and Darcy and Billy are fucking livid. So band meeting, you know, you guys are out of the band. This is bullshit. Fuck you. We're kicking you out. Blah, blah, blah. Lots of tears, lots of excuses and bullshit. And it was an accident and we won't do it again. We promise and all that kind of stuff. Let's just make it through this leg. After this leg, everybody's out, you know, and they put on their Boy Scout uniforms and they're the perfect, you know, model musician who does no drugs, you know, not out doing anything, not drinking, reading books and studying and practicing and becoming really perfect at what they do, you know. So time goes by and everybody's like, well, they're doing really great. This is amazing. Look how they are. Let's do the next leg. And you do the next leg and then they fuck up. So the second time, it was another one of those, that's it, you guys are done, you're out, blah, blah, blah. Same scenario, fast forward, you know, 7-8 months, because this is during Melancholy when the band's huge. And we're doing all these really massive shows and cool shows and really all the promo work you need to do, meeting with every record company, people going to every radio station and doing acoustic performances and just everything that you need to do to build the band to that level. Then we go to the States and we've got 2 nights sold out at Madison Square Garden. And there's a huge band meeting before it. Don't fuck this up. Don't do anything wrong. You know, you guys need to be on your best behavior. There's a lot of pressure here. If you're freaking out, let's get a counselor and who do you need to talk to? And then we ended up separating them to different hotels and putting security on their doors. And security went to bed in the middle of the night because they thought that they were in bed and they snuck out. And they went down somewhere and scored dope that was really hardcore. You know, talking with Dave Gahan, he's like, I remember Red Rum, because it was called Red Rum. He's like, I remember Red Rum in the 90s. He said every junkie in New York was looking to score it because it was the purest heroin out there. And that was it. They scored some.
It's like it's like snorting heroin, right? You're not supposed to shoot that stuff, are you?
Right. And they shot it.
Oh, man. Right. Okay. And then Jonathan didn't survive.
Right. Jimmy called me and whatever. I don't want to go into all the details. It's, you know, this is a podcast. It's.
Yeah.
Anything about any of this stuff.
Right. So I know Jimmy got dismissed. I know after that.
And right away.
Did he finish the tour, or was the Melancholy tour over with then?
That day, I chartered a plane, flew the band back to Chicago, had police, you know, go to their houses and make sure there weren't any cameras and crews and people hanging around their properties. And they went home, Bill and I, Ramey, we stayed in New York at the Mark Hotel in a 2-bedroom suite with Jimmy. So the three of us in this suite for a week until he had his court date, went to court. You know, judge said, we'll come back to this after you're done with rehab, but you mandatory have to go into rehab. And, you know, we took him, I jumped on a plane with him and took him to Minnesota and checked him in and said, hey, you know, I have a message from the guys, from Billy and Darcy and James. And, you know, they hope that you make it through rehab and everything is good, but you're no longer welcome in the band. You know, and he was like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you're fired. So there's not a job for you when this is over, but you need to get your shit together. And went back to Chicago, and within a week, you know, Q Prime was managing him at that point. And Peter had called all the top drummers in the world, you know, Terry Bozzio and Josh Freese, and all these guys flew into Chicago to audition. I think Joey Warnocker, maybe Brant Bjork. Anyway, they all came in and did an audition. And Matt Walker, who had played with Filter, who opened for the Pumpkins on the tour. I want to say the tour before Lollapalooza or just after Lollapalooza. It's a great drummer, like machine. And he lived in Chicago. So Billy said, we should give Matt Walker a shot too. And he knew all the Pumpkin songs already. And he came down and just nailed it. And they were like, great. Can you come do the rest of the tour? And he said, yes. And he jumped in and he took over for Jimmy. And that was it.
Right.
I think we
were on Dennis. Cause you did a door without Jimmy. Who played drums on a door?
Matt Cameron came down and did a couple songs. Joey Warnocker did a couple songs. I don't know what tracks made it to the record with those guys. Trying to think who else was there. A couple other drummers came in and did bits, but a lot of it was electronic drums and synths.
Oh, right.
If you listen to it, because Flood was.
You're right.
They went a total different dark route. You know, it was if you listen to that record, it's really intense. Like
they recorded that record in mono for some reason.
Yeah.
You remember that? It was in mono.
Yeah.
And then they released a version
that was in mono. They mixed one in mono, but there's also a stereo version of it.
Oh, there is.
Yeah.
There is. Okay. My copy's in mono, yeah. And then correct me, did Kenny Aronoff do the tour or somebody like that? Or is my memory serving me right?
He did. So Kenny came in for rehearsals and they loved him. So he was the drummer. And then we brought out this guy named Dan Morris as a percussion player. And then Stephen Hodges, who played with Tom Waits, as another percussion player. So Kenny's like a metronome. So you've got him in the middle playing drums with two percussionists that are in two different worlds, like insanity next to him. And he's trying to play while they're playing. And he's just going, what the fuck? You know, I can't do this. And I'm like, well, you're not a good enough drummer. And I would give him shit all the time. He's like, fuck you. I can do it. I can play. I'm way better than these guys. I'm like, then ignore him and play, you know? Yeah. And I remember there was a show, like Billy went into Cherub Rock and started doing this thing. And Kenny got to play little drums. And after he came off amped, he's like, we fucking played Cherub Rock. Did you hear that? We played Cherub Rock. I was like, no, you didn't. He's like, yes, we did. I was like, no, you didn't. He goes, go back and listen to the record. And I looked at him and I said, no, man, you need to go back and listen to the record. They didn't play the whole track, but you have to fuck with him because he's such an amazing drummer and he never missed a beat on anything. And he did it with two crazy percussionists in his ear, just playing off the wall shit. And that tour actually turned out to be pretty amazing because we did a whole bunch of really weird gigs. We were just in Bilbao like 2 weeks ago. And I went for a walk and it brought me back to this moment. We built a stage over the fountain outside of the Guggenheim, facing the park and the parking lot, and then the bridge, and the bridge is
Right there. Yep.
And the zigzag stairs that go all the way down, and the stairs were full of people. The whole bridge was full of people. The whole park was full of people. It was like 60,000-70,000 people.
Wow.
For this free outdoor show. And it was amazing. And on that whole tour, we did insane shows at different places, like playing in the Botanic Gardens in Brussels. You know, in Sydney, we played underneath the customs building in the port with the backdrop behind the band without a screen or a backdrop behind them. It was just open with the opera house there, you know, and all the hydrofoils coming in and out and, you know, filming everything too and broadcasting all the shows. And it was cool. We played at the top of the Spanish Steps in Rome. And
wow.
It was like, how weird can you make it? And talking with the label, we're like, look, you have to do stuff different. We don't want to go into the same arenas and the same venues and play. We want to do something different. So, and you pitch the label to come up with amazing ideas, and they come back with, you should play here. And then obviously, you know, Chris Dalston reached out to all the local promoters and said, here's what we want to do. And a lot of them said, you guys are fucking crazy, you know, like playing in the Reeper Bond and in the street in the Reeper Bond. Build a stage in the street, shut the street down. They're expecting 20,000 people, 65,000 people show up. They're climbing up the buildings, they're on the roofs. You know, the police are freaking out because there's too many people. And, you know, you just do it.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, not to keep going on about the Pumpkins, but, you know, as we know, Jimmy got clean. Jimmy came back in the band, you know, and he's still there. And I have to say about Jimmy Chamberlain, I don't befriend many people I work for. I'm not saying Jimmy and I are good friends, but Jimmy and I hung out a little bit. We would go out on days off together, and I really enjoyed my time hanging out with Jimmy. He's a great drummer, one of the best drummers I've ever worked with.
He's amazing. Yeah,
and everything is right in front of him. His hands are right in front of him. His hands are not up over his head. He's very efficient, and I have so much respect for that man. He is so freaking good.
Intense and amazing feel. He's different than everybody else too. I mean, you know, he was my best friend for a long, long, long time.
Really?
And we had you know, at the end of things, he and I fell out. Billy and I fell out as well. You know, it was a lot of arguments and bullshit that we don't really need to go into, but
yeah.
That
happens.
That's the biggest tragic part of it. And, you know, he sent me an email 10 years after, you know, hadn't spoken with him in 10 years. And he just sent me an email saying, hey, you know, basically sorry for all the shit that happened. Big mistake. We should try to get back together. And
oh, nice.
So, it took me a while. You know, I wrote back, thanks for your email, but, you know, God bless you and your family and all you do. I wish you the best, but I don't have time for this.
Yeah. So the Pumpkins is that's where you became who you are. You learned everything there is to be about a tour manager and booking a tour at the highest level. So you finished with the Pumpkins. What's your first major gig after the Pumpkins?
It's J-Lo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Total different world, total different vibe, you know, just insanity. Not my world. I did it for about two and a half years.
Really? That long?
Yeah. She was doing a lot of stuff. So we were always busy with whether she was filming or she was working on a record or clothing lines and perfume and this and that and appearances here and there and, you know, glam squads everywhere so that you could go get coffee and change your clothes to go get lunch and, you know, paparazzi taking photos of everything.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. Yeah. So, you know what, there's a lot to learn in that end of the world. I've done a little bit in the pop world. You know, I did a Janet Jackson tour where there's dancers coming on and off and this, that. And it was the only time I'd ever done that. And, but it was still, it was a great learning experience. I thought I did well enough for them to call me back again. But yeah, it's a completely different world.
Yeah. Crazy world. And yeah. I mean, I learned a ton and I did well and, you know, they wanted me to stay on, but we had done this. It was right after 9/11. We were actually in Culver City in the Culver City studios rehearsing for this NBC live show with, you know, this world-class percussion band, you know, some of Gloria Estefan's players, you know, horn players from Phil Collins band, just amazing musicians, shitloads of dancers, flamenco dancer from Spain, this Joaquin Cortez, who's, you know, the world's most famous flamenco dancer, flying in to do rehearsals, and 9/11 happens during rehearsals.
A bunch of
the band and crew were from New York and everybody's freaked out and we're stuck in LA. They don't know if their family's alive. You know, one of the keyboard players' brother worked in World Trade Center and he wasn't sure if he was at work and you know, it was chaos and it was nuts, but everybody made it through and nobody lost anybody from their family. One of her vocal coach lost his apartment. His building was next to it and got blown to bits. And so he had nowhere to live and he lost his dogs and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was very sad time, but they continued to work and we kept rehearsing and, you know, we were flying production crews in, you know, Hamish Hamilton, obviously.
Of course, I've done a couple. He's a famous movie. He records live shows. He shoots live shows. Pardon me.
Yeah.
He's a director.
So he and his crew were flying from London, but, you know, got grounded in other places. And so we had people scattered all over the globe trying to get to Puerto Rico for the show. Jerry Gillen was production managing.
Jerry.
Yeah. I love Jerry. He's fucking.
Yeah. He's a legend. He's
funny as shit. I can tell you stories about him all day. He's amazing. But so anyway, we're trying to figure out how to get there. And we, you know, they finally open up airports and stuff. So we charter a plane from the West Coast and anybody west of the Rockies got to LA. We flew to Atlanta and got everybody east of the Rockies to Atlanta and picked everybody up and then went to Puerto Rico and did the show. And, you know, it was massive, massive show. And it was NBC was producing it and it was J-Lo live on NBC from Puerto Rico. So we did two nights at the arena and after it all packed up, we left. And actually, I think I stayed in Puerto Rico for a week and hung out and then went to New York. And I was meeting a friend of mine who was a Pro Tools operator, playback operator. Not that we needed that on J-Lo. And we're going to go scuba diving. So I get to New York, you know, and we go downtown and see the ruins and all the shit that's going on there and the fences and all the letters and all that. It was really heavy and intense. And
I can imagine.
I don't know how it happened, but somehow Jimmy Chamberlain walked into a restaurant or a bar or something I was in and said, "I knew you were here." And I looked at him like, "What the fuck?" You know, he's like, "Hey, you need to come down to SIR tomorrow." And I was like, "Dude, I'm not interested. No fucking way. I want nothing to do with you or him or any of this. I'm out. I'm going scuba diving. Tony and I are going scuba diving tomorrow. We're going down to North Carolina and we're going diving." You know, and he's like, "Just come by. Just come by." I was like, "No, we're leaving early." He's like, "What time?" I said, 8 a.m. He's like, "Swing by SIR on your way out of town." So, of course, I swing by and it's Billy and Jimmy and Matt Sweeney. And, you know, they're playing heavy rock songs. And I was like, "This is pretty badass," you know.
Was it Zwan?
Yeah, before Zwan was actually formed, it was the three of them writing.
Okay.
And I was like, "Good for you guys. I'm out of here. I'm going scuba diving," you know. And Billy's like, "Well, are you interested?" And I said, "Nope, I'm going scuba diving." And I left. And then, you know, we went scuba diving. I came home and the phone rang and he said, he's like, "Are you home yet?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Okay, are you going to work with Zwan?" You know, and I did one of those like, I don't know. And he's like, "Just hear me out. Listen to the music. Tell me if you want to do it, blah, blah, blah." So I listened, you know, he sent me some music and I listened to it and called him back and said, "Okay, I'm in." And I went right back. I was living back in upstate because I moved back and I bought the house I grew up in and all this stuff. And
Really? Okay.
so I said, okay, I'll be out. So I jumped in my truck and I drove out to Chicago, and that was it. Stayed with Zwan, and then that fell apart, and we did his acoustic thing, and then his electronic, the Future Embrace record. Took that on the road and came home and put the Pumpkins back together.
With Jimmy.
With Jimmy, with James. No, James wasn't in it yet. Wait. James wasn't there yet. We hired this guy, Jeff Schroeder, who was with
Yeah.
them. He was probably there when you were there.
Yeah, he was. He had just resigned from the band within the last year, though.
Yeah. I don't know what happened there. I don't really have any interest in
I
the.
like Jeff. Jeff was a nice man.
He is. He's a very nice.
And Jack Bates, Hookie's son, Hookie from the Joy Division, New Order, his son Jack plays bass in the Pumpkins. He's a really, really good guy.
There were a few other people that played bass. We hired Ginger Reyes to play bass on the original reformation of the Pumpkins, and she was great. She fell in love with the keyboard player, and they got married and had kids, and they were
All right.
touring.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you had Melissa Auf der Maur before that for that was the Machina
Actually,
record, I think.
that was before the end. That was
That was back in the 90s.
Machine. It was 99. Yeah, the last bit. Their last show was at Metro, actually. The last couple.
Okay, so you meet Doc McGee and then you move on to Kiss for a while, right?
How did that happen? No. After the Pumpkins, I think it was 2007 when we split. I immediately went to work with STP.
Oh, right.
And trying to think of the chronological order. I don't remember. But I think it was STP first. It was STP first. So I went to work with STP. It was their reunion.
Yeah, I saw that show in Berkeley at the amphitheater in Berkeley.
Yeah.
I think I ran into you there, yeah.
It's a great, great band. When
Yeah,
Scott was
agreed.
on fire, it was fucking mind-boggling.
The
And they were,
DeLeo
he'd
brothers are
walk up
super
the
talented.
stage. Yeah, the DeLeo brothers are amazing. I mean, brilliant. And together they're funny, they're humble, they're incredible human beings, across the board. And Eric Kratz, amazing drummer too, and another amazing guy. Just really intense band, and you think these guys are clowns. They like to joke around. They don't take much seriously, but when they walk on stage, there's a switch that flips and they just go, we're rock guys.
Right.
Watch us. And
Yeah.
Scott, when he was on fire, he was like mind blowing. And you watch him perform and dance and sing, you're just like, holy shit.
Super
Amazing.
talent.
Yeah, it was really amazing. It was a great
Yeah.
tour. And there were a couple setbacks on that one too, and him doing stupid shit and nothing I really need to get into and share with
But
them.
you could tell by then.
Yeah.
You could tell, the by their behavior, that, this is there's something going on. Yeah.
Yeah. But there were, for the first part of it was really intense. And then shit started to go wrong. And there were days where he'd switch from whatever to this amazing rock star. I mean, literally, like walking the stage and you're going, oh boy, this is gonna be bad. This is gonna be really bad. Steve Dromowski and I both, we did that together. So standing at the side of the stage and he walks on and turns into this rock star, and you're like, holy shit, where'd he come from? Like, how did he do that? It was magic. And I've had a lot of conversations with Dean DeLeo about, there's a whole nother person in there. And when that person comes out, that's the original Scott, what they used to call Coach, because he was the guy who led the band. He led the drive. He was always getting everybody pumped up and making sure everything was running on track and you're ready for the show and let's go do this. Let's go do this. And when he came out, he was phenomenal. But when he wasn't there, it was rough.
It's great songs. Great songs.
Crazy how many hits they wrote.
Yeah. I think Robert wrote a lot of the songs, didn't he? Robert DeLeo.
He's
Wow.
still writing. He's amazing.
Yeah, I agree.
And they're still
I
touring.
agree.
You know, I don't know who the singer is, but they're still touring.
Yeah.
So from there, Depeche Mode.
Okay.
Depeche Mode.
And what was that campaign? What was that record? Is it like Playing the Angel or something like that? Or was it after
Tour
that?
After Playing the Angel. So it's either Tour of the Universe or Spirit. I think it was Tour of the Universe.
Gotcha.
And that was 2009. And then it all just rolled from there.
You so know, cool.
Literally.
So cool.
Doc McGee called me. We were in, I think, Stuttgart, maybe, final show. And, you know, after the show, I got a phone call. Hey, it's Doc McGee. And I was like, hey, Doc, what's up? And he's like, are you busy? And I said, no, I literally just finished my last show with Depeche Mode. I'm flying home tomorrow. He's like, I'm in London and I need somebody. Can you come to London? And I said, need somebody for what? And he's like, I need a tour manager. And I think Mike Amato was tour managing. And I don't know what happened, but he wasn't there anymore. He had to leave. And it, I said, sure. So I flew in. Said, where are you at? And they said, we're at Charlotte Street Hotel. So I said, great, come to the Charlotte Street Hotel. And I meet Danny Francis, who's worked with them forever, another legend in the business, who's been around forever. I mean, he started with Zeppelin back in the day and worked with Peter Grant.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He's been around forever. He did Bon Jovi and Motley Crue and all this. He's worked with Doc forever. And then obviously Kiss, and he's worked with Kiss for a long time. He's Paul Stanley's security. But amazing guy, right? So I come into the hotel, he's there to meet me, says, hey, let's, you know, this older, distinguished British gentleman says, let's sit down and have some breakfast. So you sit down, we're having breakfast, and Gene walks in, good morning, sits down, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's talking, we're eating, you know, and some fans come up and they said, excuse me. And he said, yes. And he's like, would you sign this? And he said, of course, you know, and he signed stuff and they go away. And I was like, so that's really gracious. You know, they're interrupting your breakfast and you're still signing things. And he said, well, they're my boss. You do what your boss wants. And I was like, okay, that's great. You know, and he's like, you don't have a British accent. And I said, no, I live in Chicago. And he's like, oh, you've come a long way for this. And I said, no, I just came from Germany. I was on my way home, but, you know, I came in from Germany. He's like, you must be a big fan. And I looked at him like, huh? You know, like, what? And I go, and you know, in sheer stupidity, I go, no, I was a fan when I was like five. I had Kiss Alive. I remember we got that for Christmas. And he's like, oh, very good. Yeah. Thanks. You know, and I was like, and I go, I was brought in to be your new tour manager. And he goes, oh, well, nobody tells me anything. And I go, well, maybe I'm not. And he goes, no, you probably are. I just don't know. And I look at Danny, and Danny just goes, whatever. You know, it's Gene, right? So I go, okay, well, do you want to know information? He said, that would be great. I said, okay. From now on, you'll have the information. I said, what else do you need? And he goes, I need you to keep RuPaul Stanley happy. And I said, excuse me? And he goes, when she's happy, I'm happy. Because if she's happy, we're touring. And that makes me happy because I like to tour. I look at Danny again, like, what the fuck? You know, what am I getting in? And then Doc comes in. He's like, hey, Doc McGee, you know, blah, blah, blah. Sits down. Hey,
the Doc show.
Yes. Telling 1,000 stories. And when Gene leaves, I go, he didn't know I was his tour manager. And he goes, well, did you tell him? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, then he knows. You know, and I'm like, and I go, how much information do they know? How much information should I give them? You know, he's like, you'll figure it out. Don't worry. He goes, they chew up tour managers. You won't be here very long, you know? And I was like, okay, great. So we start and we go and we play the O2 Academy, the club in London, right?
Oh, yeah.
We have dressing rooms in the Hilton Hotel across the street. I come in, you know, and the wardrobe girls have got 10 rooms taken. The whole hallway is full of shit and gear and their costumes and outfits and makeup room and all this. And, you know, they're getting ready. They get ready. They walk out these, you know, superhero characters. You're like, holy shit, it is a comic book, you know, and they're walking down the hall in the elevator, down, getting the car. We go across the street, going to O2. They do the show. We leave, get in the cars, go back to the hotel. And Gene looks and he goes, what is this? And I said, it's the dressing rooms. He goes, no. After show, I go to my hotel. I just close the door on the van. It's great. Tell the driver we're going to Charlotte Street, get on the phone, call the wardrobe girl, said, Gene's going to the Charlotte Street Hotel. You better bring bags to get his shit. She's like, oh my God, he's supposed to be here. I was like, he's going to his room. Call the hotel, talk to the manager. Can you hold the elevator? I've got Gene Simmons coming in, full garb. Saturday night, Charlotte Street's kind of a hotel that's this, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's these nice rooms in a quaint little hotel with a busy, busy restaurant bar. So packed. So the lobby's packed. The front street's packed with people outside smoking. We pull up, van door opens, I get out. He climbs out of the van in his gear. 7 feet tall, all his spikes and blood all over his face, his makeup. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. People are like, you know, smoking, looking like, what the fuck? And you got drunk people going, holy shit, that's the guy from Kiss. You know? And we walk in, and the manager's got the elevator door. He ducks to go in the elevator, gets in, close the door, go get up there. There's somebody with his room door open, walk out, bring him into his room. I go, all right, Renee will be here with the stuff soon. See you later. And he's like, no way, young man. And I go, what? And he goes, I can't get out of this. You know, and I'm looking at him going, I'm not getting you out of your shit. You're sweaty and nasty and gross and covered in weird blood. Like, this is not my gig. There isn't there's not much I won't do. But I was looking like, this is not something I'm going to do, you know? And he's like, you have to. So I go, how do you get out of it? And he goes, there's clips everywhere. You have to unbuckle me, right? So I start unbuckling and he starts dropping his armor and then his boots. He's like, I can't get my boots off. I'm like, come on. And I'm like, seriously? You know? And he goes, yes. He goes, I'm the one in it. You don't have to feel like I do, you know? And I'm like, okay. So I unzip his boots and yank his boots off. And then I'm like, all right, that's it. I'm out. I'm going to go. She should be here any minute. And he's standing in this leotard, you know, this leotard with the zipper on the back. He goes, you need to unzip me. And my mind's going, what the fuck am I doing? I can't believe I'm here.
So this is your first gig.
Yes. Look, 10 hours before, he didn't know I was his tour manager. Now I'm undressing the guy, right? Going, this is insane. So I, you know, unzip him and I peel the thing off his shoulders and I'm like, I'm not staying for the rest of this. You can get this. And he's like, thank you. You know, and I leave and I go downstairs and here comes Renee with all her bags and she's like, sorry, I didn't know he was gonna do that. And I was like, I'm never doing that again. We're not gonna have this mistake again. I need to know where he's going every time. And if he's going somewhere else, you need to be there before he gets there. And she's like, deal, no problem. So, you know. Immediately, I was like, okay, I need to work out everything that needs to be done with these things. And it turned out to be great.
Oh, how funny. And how many years were you with Kiss?
On and off. I think I left for a Depeche Mode tour and then came back. And so I'd say 7 years, maybe.
Okay.
And then
you're one of the few tour managers that can, you know, you're tall enough to look him in the eye when he's got his kid on almost.
Well, it was no bullshit either. You know, I asked Paul what you wanted and I made sure he was happy in his bubble. And that's all he wanted. He wanted information, wanted to know where he was going, when he was going, and he wanted things to run efficiently because obviously they run a business, you know, and the show is a big part of their business, but they run business behind the scenes. They run a VIP meet and greet thing. So every day it's, we come in, you come to the gig early, you leave the hotel at noon, you go to the gig, they set up for an acoustic performance. They do an acoustic performance for anywhere between 70 and 90 people. And then they sign autographs for everybody and talk to each person as they do it. Then they go back, have dinner, and then they get dressed and they put on all their own makeup. They do all their own stuff. They get dressed, they come out, and they do individual photos with everybody that was at the VIP thing. So, you know, and they bring them in. They're like, hey, and they're engaging with the people because they're the people buying the VIP experience, and they're giving them a real VIP experience. And then after that, they take photos with, you know, between 200 and 1,000 people a night, and they do that in groups. So you move five people in, five people, and you keep this line going, you know.
It's hard work, man.
Work, 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 work. And then it goes, okay, photos are done, walk back to the dressing room, they put their ears in, they, you know, Paul stretches and gets ready, and that you hear the intro start in the arena, and they go up behind the kabuki, and, you know, flying pieces all over the place. They're lifted into the rafters, and, you know, their guitar tech grabbed the microphone and does, "You wanted the best, you got the best, the hottest band in the land, Kiss," and explodes, and kabuki drops, and
awesome.
They come flying out of the ceiling, you know, and you're like,
awesome.
Concussions everywhere, missed notes, horrible playing, but, you know, fire and you know, it was a spectacle. But, you know, the point is they constantly work. So it was all about organizing their days so that they had a schedule, you know. And it's amazing because there are other bands you could go, "Let's go." And they're like, "I'm not ready." Like with Billy, if he didn't want to go on yet, it's like, "Not yet." And everybody sits and waits. And you're like going, "Hey, we're supposed to be on 10 minutes ago. When I'm ready," you know, that kind of shit. With them, it's, if they were on a schedule, anytime I lifted my arm, they would walk straight to me. Doesn't matter who they're talking to. They'd be like, "I got to go. Thanks. See you later." And they'd walk over and we'd go somewhere. And that was, so it was always on the clock doing what they needed to do. And they did it every day. And they had a lot of respect for that, you know. And I took them to the airport and I was sending them off on their flight. And it's funny because Paul, he gave me a hug and he said, "Hey man, you did a great job. Really great. Best tour manager we've ever had." And of course, Doc's standing there and he's like, "What are you doing? Giving him hand jobs?"
Like, "No." Now he's going to ask for more money.
So, you know, and Gene, same thing. He's like, "Thank you, young man." And off he went. And, you know, I joined on the next leg and it just turned into, this is how it works.
Right. And
they, you know, all the stuff was going on in the Middle East and they're Jewish and they were really worried about security. So being in Europe, they put together a tour and then it canceled. And then they put together another one and they pulled out again. I think some other crazy shit was going on. They're like, "Look, this is not the time for us to be over there. And we really need to think about what we're doing." And then Elliot Roberts called. And that was that. And then to Neil, and then Doc called and he said, "Hey, we're going to go back out." And I said, "I'm in Europe with Neil. I can't be there, you know?" And he said, "Well, we're going to put the dates together." So he put all the dates together and I advanced everything, booked all the hotels and cars and all that stuff. Cool. And I would send him a day sheet every night. And they hired Steve Toth to come in. So I'd send him the day sheet and he'd run the day-to-day operations. And I stayed with Neil and Tothy stayed with them until the end.
Right. Man, you work with these artists that I've just been in my psyche, been in my life, been in my ears since, you know, since I was a kid, you know, Neil Young and Kiss and not so much Depeche Mode, but it's incredible.
It's funny. One quick story. My very first concert was in Syracuse, New York at the New York State Fairgrounds. Me and my brothers snuck into the grandstand. You climb the fence and sneak under the grandstand. We're under the grandstand watching the show between people's legs. Neil Young and Crazy Horse on a flatbed trailer on the dirt racetrack at the New York State Fairgrounds.
Wow.
That's the first concert I ever saw. And I was like, wow, you know, and I think back to it and I'm like, holy shit. You know, when I got hired to work with Neil, I did that like, wow. Cause I'd met him a few times at doing bridge school and you meet him in passing and, you know, he invites everybody to his house and there's a big barbecue and you see him there and you're like, wow, that's Neil Young. Holy shit. That's Neil Young. Holy shit. That's Neil Young. But when you're hired to work with him, then you're like, whoa, that's Neil Young. And this is real. I better not fuck it up, you know?
Mm. Well, the time before last I saw you was at Desert Trip.
Yeah.
And he was my favorite artist on Desert Trip. Him with Willie's Kids, The Promise of the Real in the band. I really thought, and I saw it both weekends, I thought Neil Young was, this just fucking blew me away. He was so, so good. You know,
what's funny though is he's all the pomp and circumstance that went into that show because it was huge, you know, and it was the first time ever being done anything like that. And I remember the phone call of the video wall and, you know, he and Steve and Elliot on the phone and they're talking about how excited they are about the wall. And then he hangs up the phone and he goes, "Okay, we need to figure out how to cover that wall." And everyone's like, what? So Springo's doing this next run with us, and he and I were talking about it, and he's like, yeah, like, because it was really windy that day. Steve was like, well, what are we going to use to cover the wall? You know, and he kept trying to figure something out. And he said, how about a burlap seed bag? And Neil was like, that's great. So Steve had this giant seed bag, organic seeds made to be behind the band. And then we just got tons of burlap scrim and dragged it all the way out to the end. So the iMag was still available on the end of the screens and, you know, the TPs and all that.
Yep.
And the flags from all the nations around the world that were protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. And, you know, and he just nonchalantly like, hey, man, let's just go in and chill, you know. And McCartney wanted to rehearse with him because McCartney wanted him to play with him and all this stuff. And they never ended up meeting up to rehearse. And whether that was intentional or not, it's Neil. It was intentional.
Yeah.
McCartney wanted to rehearse because he rehearses everything. And Neil's like, fuck it, let's just play. You know,
yeah,
it will be what it's, you know, it is. And he's like, his band rehearses their rehearsals. So they know what they're doing. I know what I'm doing. We'll see if it works, you know? And
yeah,
sure enough, you know, the compounds there, they took all the dressing rooms and made them individual compounds. So there's tons of space. And ours was a ghost town because Neil didn't want anybody in there. And I'm standing there and, you know, he's on his bus and I see McCartney. I go, uh-oh, here comes McCartney. And he's like, well, I'm going to work out. He walks over to, he's got a gym in his trailer. So he walks over and goes into the gym. And McCartney comes over and he's like, where's Neil? You know, and I'm like, holy shit, you're Paul McCartney. That's all I could think was, holy shit, you're Paul McCartney. He's pissed and he's got his guitar. And I was like, he's in the truck. You know, so I go over, open the door, and McCartney walks up inside and he's like, Neil? And you hear Neil go, oh, hey, Paul, what's up? You know, and he's like, we need to rehearse. He's like, okay, let's do it. So McCartney just starts playing his guitar and Neil stands up in front of him and they go over what they want to do, you know, and I'm standing there with the door open going, that's Paul McCartney. Right. And then I'm like, shit, I better close the door. I close the door and Elliot's down behind the truck looking around the corner. Like, is everything okay? You know, I was like, Paul McCartney's in there. He's like, I know.
Oh man.
They rehearsed it.
I thought
that first night they went out and it was really stiff. I don't know if you remember that or if you watched that performance. Right?
I don't remember it, if I'm honest.
Okay, so he played with McCartney and he went out and it was really stiff and it wasn't that great. So he thought, well, that won't happen again. And sure enough, the next day McCartney called him and said, let's do it again next weekend. And he's like, oh boy. So then the next weekend he went out and everybody was relaxed and it was fucking nuts. Like, gave me goosebumps. Like, you know, you're doing the holy shit. Like, they're really rocking out and they were jamming. The band was able to let loose and jam with them and freeform. And it was probably one of the greatest moments I've seen in rock.
Wow. You know, the one thing I can say about his shows at Desert Trip is everybody else had a set list and they were time coded and it was just so scripted. And his was just so organic. And if he wanted to feed back his guitar for an extra 30 seconds, he would do that. I mean, it was just nothing. It was just, you know, organic is the best thing I can say about it.
That's him. I mean, he's all about energy and what he's feeling. You know, it's never a scripted set list. If you look at his set list on stage, there's like 120 songs on it. And that's the group that he's pulled from. Or when he's playing with Promise of the Real, they would, you know, Lucas would say, hey, let's do this song next. And they would go into it. And then at one point, Lucas was like,
that's Willie's kid, Lucas Wilson.
Yeah, Lucas Nelson. Yeah, he's
Nelson, yeah.
And he and the drummer, Anthony, they met at a Neil Young show and became friends and then formed a band, which is a great story too. But they knew, they went and researched all of the songs that he's never played live. So they put the list together and then came to Neil and said, these are all the songs you haven't played live. We want to pick one per show and play them. And Neil's like, I don't know him. And they're like, well, we've rehearsed them all. We know him. So we can walk you through during rehearsal and warm up. So 30 minutes before you go on stage, you're in the truck that's the gym and there's a Whirly in there. And, you know, they start doing vocal warm-ups and then they go into what song he hasn't played that they're going to do. And then they throw it in the set somewhere. So it was always audible calls. You know, there's a basic structure of how it's going to go, but things got tossed here and moved there and turned into, you know, this or that. And, you know, Jarmowski would time every show. And when Neil comes off, he tells him how long he played. And, you know, there was a gig in, I want to say Lucca, which is the walled city, one of the ancient.
In Tuscany.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it's the gig where you have to walk in because the buses and trucks can't make it into the city. And the whole town is packed, like the square and all the streets going out. And it's just packed.
Yeah.
And they went on and it was insane. Like it was one of those shows where the vibe was right. The energy was right. The people were right. The temperature, everything was phenomenal. And Neil walks off and he looks at Steve and he goes, boy, what do we do, Steve? 2 hours, 2.5? And Steve goes, no, 3 hours and 47 minutes. And he's like, oh, that was a long one. You know, and they walked away like, all right.
Oh, wow.
So
now go ahead, please.
The point is, he's you said organic and he's super organic. Everything's about vibe and energy. And, you know, everybody that works with him, you either fit or you don't. You know, you have to have skills, but you also have to have the right energy, and you have to be chill, but you have to be intense at certain points. And, you know, he expects the best out of everybody, crew, band, everybody.
Because I can imagine
the best he is. It's like, look, man, here's what we're doing. Let's go do it. And let's have fun doing it. It's music. It's about love and it's about energy. And, you know,
that's awesome. Awesome. You know, we talking to you for this last little bit, you know, the theme keeps coming around. It's all about organization. It's all about communication. And I think this is, you know, you were talking about Kisser superheroes. That's what makes you the superhero you are in this industry. You know, your reputation says that. And it's the most important thing we have in our industry is organization and communication. Don't you think?
I do. I think more on a production, you know, production is super organized. You have to be spot on with every bit of it. Same with tour management, but it's a different thing because you have to free flow. Like I said, with every artist, they're all different, you know, and you have to do what they need. Like Dave Gahan is very structure oriented. Every single day is down to minutes. When things happen, exercises, vocal exercises, steams, you know, in the gym, what time you leave for the gig, how long you're at the gig, you know. Every bit of it. Same with Kiss. Everything is about, they're about the business, and you have to structure every day in time frames for the business. It's like production, load in, set up, how pieces go together, how everybody works together. It comes up, it forms into this thing. They go on stage, they perform, it tears down, it goes into trucks. Efficiency is important to a lot of musicians. With Neil, efficiency is important, but it has to be laid back. And it has to be more about the music than it is about this is not right or that's not right. You know, as long as the music is allowed to be performed, life is good. But if the music can't be performed, then shit hits the fan. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. You know, and every artist is different. You're right. You know, and sometimes we just have to figure it out.
Well, on a production level too, you know, somebody's got some harebrained idea, you know, some artists get it and they understand, and you can tell them, look, this is the way it is. Others are going to be like, no, here's what I want.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't just go to them and say, well, tough shit, you're not getting that. You have to go, okay, well, if you want this, here's what we have to do. And here's why it doesn't work, and explain it. And, you know, some of them will bend and others will be like, well, fuck that. I get somebody new because this is what I want.
Yeah. 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 There's the artist that won't take no for an answer, you know, but you know, we don't say no much, do we? We always say yes, but here are the conditions for the yes.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a lot.
Well, Gooch, this has been incredible. You know, I could go on all day. I could go as long as a long Neil Young set list with you right now, but, you know, I appreciate the time you spent with us. This has been absolutely fucking magic.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Matt, what do you have for Gooch?
At the risk of maybe offending other guests, that was, I tell you, Gooch, you're a storyteller. You're the recall, the information, the color, the picture that that you put in my mind with everything you said was fantastic. Thank you for sharing. Wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
So I hope to see you when you come to New Orleans on Jazz Fest. So
we will definitely
I'm
be
home.
There.
Stay in touch. Stay in touch, my friend. Yeah,
you're on the East Coast, right?
I am. I was just going to say, I hope to see you May 18th in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Maybe.
Are we in Bridgeport on the 18th?
That's what Neil's tour schedule says.
Sorry, I have to look. Going to best mode world.
We can talk about that off air here, but because I've met you virtually, I've met Springo virtually, so I'd like to meet you guys in person if possible.
It's definitely possible. Let's make it happen.
Fantastic. Cool. Excellent. Well, I can't, again, that was phenomenal. Thank you for sharing everything and taking the time to, tell us about, you and in this industry that's just an amazing, it's an amazing thing. So thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you guys. I mean, what you're doing is pretty great. I love listening to your podcast. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right, my brother, enjoy your time at home. Thanks. No matter how brief it is.
You as well. I see you
guys. Thank you.
Matt.
Until next time.
See you guys.
Take care. Bye.